Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got quite a bit going this week for this evening program. And today, July the 10th, 2021, we've had just a great number of very important issues. We've had this critical race theory that's being combated now by many, you could say, parents out there that are just overwhelming displeased with what's going on. But also behind the shadows there, especially in the Catholic schools, there's been a teaching of what they call liberation theology. And this was the idea that Jesus was a socialist communist. And so that's behind really deeply seated in on a deep level of some of the Catholic teachings, but at a higher level. But anyway, so Catholic parents out there, look into this liberation theology. Get to know what that is. One of the leading proponents or fathers of that movement is Emeritus, Professor Emeritus Gutierrez up in Notre Dame. So this reaches wide and far, and this whole communist movement is much more involved than you could ever imagine. But anyway, we're going to start off with a clip from Jay Dyer, and he talks about Sutton, Anthony Sutton, but also Quigley. Carol Quigley wrote a couple of books, Tragedy and Hope, and another one. It would be the Anglo-American Establishment. So Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American Establishment were two of the books that Carol Quigley wrote, and he gives great insight. And here's Jay Dyer testifying on some of the insights that he's garnered, I could say, from these two books. Here we go now.
Books of the elite. That is the writings of the elite themselves that go into great detail as to how they would conduct the next phase of their business plan to bring in the technocratic global order. Of course, the magnum opus of that is Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley, but a lot of people don't know that Quigley wrote another book. He was the professor at Georgetown, the military historian, archivist for the CFR. His book, Tragedy and Hope, of course, was given to CIA operatives back in the 70s, 60s, Cold War era to help them understand why would we as Western powers be aiding at times communists, right? Doesn't that seem to go against the logic of the Cold War? And so the apologetic of Tragedy and Hope is geared towards explaining a lot of these kinds of seeming contradictions in the Western approach to the Cold War. And as we all know, Quigley's whole thesis is that the tragedies were the two world wars and the Cold War, and the hope was Western globalist capitalist democracy. Of course, capitalist there means neoliberalism in the sense of crony capitalism, in the sense of top-down control corporatism. All right, so we're not talking about the older free market model. We're talking about the control of the oligarchs. But what a lot of people don't know is that Quigley wrote another important book. In ways, it was more important than Tragedy and Hope due to a lot of the details that he spilled in terms of who actually ran the global government. So while Tragedy and Hope gives you this 1,300-page history and kind of apologetic defense of what was going on and why the elite engineered the two world wars and the Cold War, the Anglo-American establishment tells you who's behind it. So we're going to be going through some of this forgotten classic here, the Anglo-American Establishment. And it, again, it parallels very well with Alex's documentary. So quickly starts off by talking about in the early phases of the British, of the 20th century, by about 1920s, the British Empire had come up with a plan that they called the Commonwealth of Nations. And so this is where we get Chatham House, this is where we get the Cliveden set, we get these sort of circles of elites and lords who said, all right, look, British Empire represents the greatest ascent in human evolution, quite literally. They thought that it was the apex of evolutionary ascent. And this is tied in, of course, with Darwinism, right? The adoption of the Darwinistic religion, really. If you read what Darwinism actually is, it goes back to ancient Hinduism. You can see then, of course, the British preference for the Hindu caste system. It meshes perfectly with the Darwinian, social Darwinian perspective of how to structure society in this way. And so they quickly points out certain figures and thinkers who were kind of the ideologues. There's John Ruskin, who thought that we should instantiate a global socialism under the British Empire. There's Toynbee. There's H.G. Wells, right? These different thinkers who said, let's divide up the world and put it under the aegis of the British Empire. In fact, Toynbee would be the key to giving us the ideology, or giving them the ideology, I should say. And by 1938, through this secret society at Oxford, Cambridge, and other schools, through the support of banking elites like the Morgans, the Rothschilds, the Rhodes Trust, the Bight Trust, Lazard Brothers and Company, they had essentially taken over the entire intellectual apparatus of the British Empire. So this was the dominant force by that time, by the 30s and 40s. We can see that this will lead to, of course, not just the creation of the League of Nations earlier than that, but it will even lead to the creation of the United Nations by the same power structure, because they're allied with the Rockefeller power structure, the J.P. Mellon, J.P. Morgan Mellon Carnegie Trust in the U.S. They're linked together. But quickly goes on to talk about the fact that by the 1920s, 30s, 40s, they had not just controlled the universities in the U.K., but that they'd also gained control of the Church of England. The whole Anglican apparatus, which was always kind of a tool of the British crown all the way back to, Henry VIII, they had co-opted the ministers in the church. And this is paradigmatic for the way it works now, right? Remember that this is not different. This superstructure, this octopus operates the exact same way now. They do the exact same thing where they co-opt and buy off churches and religions to be the arms of this global technocratic order. Now, it's true that we're not under the old British imperial system anymore. But what the Pax Americana became, as we'll see here in a little bit, was laid out by these Royal Society strategists. Now, the Royals also birthed this steering committee idea of the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And this is the Milner Group and all the same people involved in what I'm talking about now. They set up this idea of, let's have a modern kind of round table of knights or elites who will steer the globe into the liberal world order.
When we talk about the world order or the new world order, and we have to look at a whole series of different, you could say, institutions and movements that were established over several hundred years. And I think Jay Dyer was just talking about the British the Anglo establishment there. But they're very important because of the money base, the City of London and so forth. But what we have next is an interview that Bonnie Faulkner had, Guns and Butter, with Michael Hoffman. And he writes about the occult in a way of psychodramas and things like this on very wide scale types of ideas and movements. But also, he talks about the revelation of the method, which is it's an idea that the occultists, before they carry out some of their plans, they announce it, that what they're going to do in advance. See, and everyone is wondering, well, why do they do that? But I think you have to look at it with the idea of them marshaling intentions of millions of other occultists along with them that give them more power to carry out these very diabolical deeds. So I believe that's really what we've got to start looking at. But what's happening in this world today is that people have been researching these mind traps and this mind control and this, you could say, mind mesmerizing systems. And they're beginning to rebel against some of these real powerful groups. That's why I think this pandemic and all this are being used to close down some of those groups and their research. But here we go with Michael Hoffman being interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner. And it's really insightful stuff. So here we go. Listen to this and then we'll get on to the next clips.
We could begin to see a pattern which is not necessarily morbid and is not necessarily controlled by the cryptocracy that is actually very wonderful and magnificent. And it's just that some of these criminal psychopaths have seized onto the technology and used it to their own means. But it might be that there's so much more of reality that we're not seeing in our shuttered little daily, day-to-day lives that could be brought out by tracking these coincidences, which might serve us very well and might serve the cause of truth itself. I think that it's unfortunate that very ambitious, egotistical people have taken control over phenomena that may very well be neutral.
You have written, quote, "But this is the revelation of the method era. This is the time when they show us what they are doing to us. The method is revealed for all to see." So do you feel that the present day is some sort of a peak in this revelation of the method operation?
Yes, I do. We have been desensitized to these things. And the speed with which visual images are being processed, many films, documentaries, advertisements will open up with 50,000 images passing through our eyes in the matter of moments. Things like that where it would have been off-putting to people 30 or 40 years ago. They would have said, gee, that's weird. That's not human scale. You know, when I went to England and I saw Saxon architecture compared with the architecture that was created after the Normans, the Saxon architecture was all human scale. And the Norman architecture was the architecture we associate with the Middle Ages, like in York Minster Cathedral with the world's largest stained glass, that gigantism, which incidentally you also see, for what it's worth, in the American West. If you're in the East, you're in the Appalachian Mountains. I realize this is the process of erosion over, you know, many thousands of years, but you're in Appalachia and there's a more human scale to the toponymy. If you're in the American West, there's this sense of gigantism. The natural monuments of the landscape are huge, and man and woman are shrunk in proportion to that. That's something that Mr. Downard wanted to study and wanted, because he was fascinated by why was New Mexico, the so-called land of enchantment, you know, that's the slogan of the place. Why was that chosen as the crucible where what he called the creation and destruction of primordial matter at the Trinity site? Why did it happen there and not somewhere else? And so that created a larger study. Again, in this wondrous, Mr. Downard had a wondrous ability to enlarge our perspective on what forces are at work here, apart from who's carrying the gun and who drove the getaway car. We really have to expand how we look at these things. And, of course, he was mainly concerned with pattern detection.
And finally, you write that it is the subconscious that is being addressed in occult ritual. Could you explain what you mean by the group mind or the dreaming mind? And you've already talked a little bit about that. How does the group mind get imprinted?
Well, they're going right over our rational speaking mind, and this is what a hypnotist does as well with hypnotic cues, and I recommend that people make a study of hypnotism, the history of hypnotism and its methodology, along with, I'll add parenthetically, the methodology of high-end advertising. These are expert at the manipulation of the mind. And so the dreaming mind, the subconscious mind, the mind that is active while we're asleep, is basically always there. It's always on. We turn off our rational mind when we sleep. We never turn off our subconscious. And so the question is there a language that talks over our rationality, over our everyday language, and speaks to that mind? And I would say the entire impact of my work and the whole raison d'etre of what I'm doing is basically to try and impart that understanding to people that through these criminal masterminds and these acts of criminality, there is a message being sent to that dreaming mind, and it's a message of overwhelming terrorism, force, and power. Surrender to us. There is no alternative. And that message is imparted by means of words of power, known as twilight language.
He talks about twilight language. So I'll have an internet address on our site, thesecrettruth.com, so you can listen to that total interview, okay? But it's about 50-something minutes long. But it's very, very fascinating. And, of course, people are down on him all the time. He mentions in there about advertising. I've noticed something very profound in my, you know, studies and research over the years is that we used to see advertising, whether it's on radio or television or whatever, that pushed the product. Now, if you look at some of these pharmaceutical ads, they put the product out there, but it's the psychological benefits of family and the happiness and riding bicycles and going skiing and water skiing and jumping in a pond and all this other stuff. At the same time, they're rolling all of the side effects that you have to be careful about as warnings to protect themselves. So this is just really fascinating what's going on, but it's tragic what's happening in this country now. So what I'm going to come up next with is there was a book written called The Cheating Culture by David Callahan in the early 2000s, I think 2004 or 5. And we'll have a click off in there where you can listen to that full interview that was on YouTube. But what I want to do is inject into here is that starting with Johns Hopkins out of the behavioral school came advertising. And some of the top advertising executives located on Madison Avenue in New York City. But so they started using deep psychological behavioral types of approaches to the advertising. But today it's even more deeply ingrained in especially these pharmaceuticals, which put forward the idea that you're going to lead a wonderful, wonderful life. But anyway, this is an interview that was conducted just recently on The Open Mind. David Callahan is saying some very interesting things about the cheating culture. He says the top level, you know, people get away with murder. And that's what Michael Hoffman was saying, is that they're maneuvering us and softening us up through psychodramas that we can't resist doing, you know, going against the power structure is no good. You're not going to win. So just give up, you know, and be a servant, be a slave to this system. But anyway, this is David Callahan talking about the cheating culture.
I'm Richard Heffner, your host on The Open Mind, and the idea I would like to pursue here today derives from a compelling new Harcourt book titled The Cheating Culture, Why Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead. Its author, my guest, is David Callahan, a Princeton University PhD in politics and the co-founder of Demos, a new public policy think tank based in New York. Now, I must say that what I find particularly intriguing about Dr. Callahan's chronicle of cheating and dishonesty in contemporary America, in our sports, in our business affairs, in our professions, politics, and personal lives, is his insightful and rather unique emphasis on the resurgence, the newly powerful role in our thinking over at least the past generation or so of 19th century social Darwinism. This means, of course, an individualistic, marketplace-based dog-eat-dog, sink-or-swim, survival of the fittest, I'm all right, Jack, and the devil take the hindmost, emphasis on free enterprise, social and economic thinking that is very little concerned with anything other than number one. Indeed, Dr. Callahan leaves very little to the imagination in the connection he draws between this newly dominant laissez-faire ideology and our cheating culture. And I would ask him today to elaborate upon his insistence that Americans never sympathetic to life's losers seem to grow even more callous towards the weak during the 1980s and 90s. We also turned more worshipful of the strong, namely the rich and famous. Why are these attitudes relevant to cheating, asked my guest? Because it is a small step from believing that big shots intrinsically deserve their power to indulging the abuse of that power. Is that the basis for your thinking about we American cheaters?
That's pretty much it. You know, cheating is not a new phenomenon in the United States. We've always had cheating. This is always been kind of a cutthroat culture, and there's always been a kind of rough and tumble aspect to American life. But I argue that in the 80s and 90s, it became even more rough and tumble, nastier, more cutthroat. Kind of like the 20s, kind of like the robber baron era of 100 years ago. You know, Ronald Reagan came to office in 1981, and he said in his inaugural address that, you know, government was not the solution, government was the problem. And for the past two decades, we've had this relentless attack on government and the message that, you know, nobody should be there to catch you if you fall. And I think when we have that kind of message coming from our leaders and infusing our culture, people, you know, they'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah, but wait a minute. One, on the one hand, nobody should be there to catch you when you fall. Isn't that a stretch to nobody should be there to make sure you don't knock the other fellow over?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. We've had the government watchdogs that are supposed to be the referees of fair economic competition, the IRS, the SEC, which polices Wall Street. These agencies have been starved of resources over the past two decades. The people at the top, the rich, the powerful, the CEOs, my argument is that these people have been cheating because they think they can get away with it. And it's been largely a rational view that there's just nobody who's out there who's going to be able to go up against their top-notch legal talent.
A rational view.
It's a rational view, I think so, that, you know, money buys you legal defense in this country. You got a lot of money, you can get great lawyers, you can tie those government prosecutors up in knots, you can come into the courtroom and keep these people busy for 4 months, like we've seen in the Tyco trial with Dennis Kozlowski. That trial's been going on for 4 months. Show anyone, any jury, 10,000 documents over a four-month period. They're not going to know what to believe by the time they get into a jury room. It's very hard to prosecute these white-collar cases. So the people at the top, they can get away with cheating and believe that. Ordinary people see this. They feel the system is stacked against them. They feel the rules aren't fair. And so they think, well, why should I play by the rules?
Well, there seems to be, as I read through your book, a kind of harshness in your concern about the absence of punishment.
Right.
And this is obviously what you're talking about. But you start off listing the absence of punishments in terms of a lot of kids, a lot of school children. Now, you say these are the school children who are the children of very wealthy people,
right,
and that's why they get away without any punishment at all. But this is obviously a major concern of yours. The no punishment society,
well,
you're from underneath.
Well, some people aren't punished in this society. You know, today we have more people in prison than ever, 2 million people in prison. We have a lot of people serving these long mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenses. And yet, you know, when it comes to more privileged people, we have a completely different view of punishment. The draconian get-tough attitude of the last two decades has only applied to part of the population. So I get through my book all the ways in which we've indulged cheaters. You look at the professional class, doctors, lawyers, stockbrokers. You know, the associations that are supposed to be policing those professionals have been falling asleep on the job. The state bar associations that are supposed to get rid of crooked lawyers, if they're caught overbilling clients or doing other kinds of wrong things. Those associations have been extremely weak in the 80s and 90s. The state medical societies, they're supposed to police doctors. They're not doing the job.
You say falling asleep on their jobs. Is that what you mean, or are they doing what they were intended to do? Are they doing what voluntarism is supposed to do?
Well, there's lots of different stories here. State bar associations, what has happened there is that they've been sort of co-opted by their members. And instead of looking out for the public and protecting clients' interests and the consumer interests, they've been often looking out for lawyers in their state. And they've also been starved of resources that, these state bar associations just aren't being able to deploy the resources to do the job. So you have these crooked lawyers who they get caught overbilling and nothing happens to them, and the public can't even find out which lawyers are dishonest out there because these records are kept from the public. Same with doctors.
Well, did you hear what he said about punishment? Nonviolent drug offenders are getting long sentences, sometimes mandatory. While, we have a case just recently of Avenatti, and he got 30 months. And he was trying to extort millions of dollars from Nike, but he was convicted just recently. So he only gets 30 months for trying to get millions, and many of these nonviolent drug, users or whatever gotten much longer sentences than that. It's just not fair. They don't have any money. They don't have any attorneys. So there again, that big money makes a big difference, But so what we're going to have next is a report from Tucker Carlson. He called that Avenatti out way back. And listen to this. This is quite an interview.
Ever notice how heroes just emerge? They're not so much born as they just appear out of nowhere. And that happened a few years ago in this country. Now, that hero went by many names. We called him the creepy porn lawyer because he was. But over at CNN, they called him something different. They called him a future president.
Value most. If they decide they value a fighter most,
yes,
people would be foolish to underestimate Michael Avenatti.
Existential threat to the Trump presidency. Please welcome attorney Michael Avenatti.
No one has talked tougher directly to Donald Trump on TV than Michael Avenatti, and Donald Trump is afraid to mention his name.
Michael Avenatti is a beast.
Okay, that's true.
And
he's a beast.
He's a beast, and he keeps popping Donald Trump and all of his folks in the mouth repeatedly. He's a beast. And so John Meacham says he may be the savior of the republic.
I owe Michael Avenatti an apology. For the last couple of weeks, I've been saying, enough already, Michael. I've seen you everywhere. What do you have left to say? I was wrong, brother.
Those were not cable news clips. That was an IQ test, and everybody on that tape failed miserably. Do not issue them driver's licenses. They're not capable. They fell for it hard. In a single week in March of 2018, if you can remember that far back, MSNBC, CNN, ABC, CBS, and NBC News interviewed the creepy porn lawyer a total of, not making this up, because we counted, 147 times. They said, wait, we got to get in on that. We got to interview the creepy porn lawyer. We had only one opportunity to talk to him in studio. Here's part of it. You've profited from Stormy Daniels. You've done tens of millions of dollars worth of free media on the basis of your relationship with her, and she's working in strip clubs. You're exploiting her, and you know that. Why aren't you paying her some of what you're making?
Sir, this is absurd.
But answer my question. Why are you rich and your client is working in seedy strip clubs?
Sir, do you have any idea how much money I've earned?
You're on every cable show. You're running for president now.
You have no idea.
Well, I know that you haven't paid your taxes, and like so many lawyers, you were taking advantage of her. And you pose as a feminist hero because you are shameless, and the other channels let you get away with it. But you're an exploiter of a woman, and you should be ashamed of it. So it wasn't the warmest interview ever, and actually got even more unpleasant off air. But we wanted to give you the coda to the story. How did it wind up? Where is he now? Well, today, the creepy porn lawyer met the fate so many of us knew was coming to him. He was sentenced to 30 months in prison, in this case for trying to extort the shoe company, Nike. By the way, he's still facing several separate trials, including one concerning allegations that he defrauded Stormy Daniels, which he apparently did. So the question for us is basically a political show, is what does this mean for creepy porn lawyer's presidential ambitions? Is he still what America needs? Francie Hakes is a former federal prosecutor. She joins us tonight. Francie, thanks so much for coming on. And I should say, with some sincerity, I never gloat over a man going to prison because, it's sad. It's like someone's death. It is sad. I mean that. However, if there was ever a guy who had a rendezvous with a cell, inevitably, it was this guy. Was that obvious to you as a former prosecutor?
Yeah, Tucker, he certainly had that defense attorney bluster, that incredible arrogance that used to drive me so crazy across the courtroom when they were performing really for an audience of one, their own client, and never for the jury and never for the judge. He was really just like a normal criminal defense attorney to me. But today in court, he certainly didn't have that arrogance, as he was apparently sobbing with regret. And I just have to say, that's one of the things that used to drive me the most crazy as a prosecutor, was watching the defendant next to me cry and sob. Because where was that emotion? Where was that regret when they were victimizing their victims? And here he had an extortion scheme. It's not like I feel sorry for the shoe company, but the point is that he's got an extortion scheme to extort a shoe company. He's paying the price. Now he's going to prison for less than the federal sentencing guidelines recommended, by the way, which was 9 years. But still, I'm not at all surprised that he had such a rise and such a meteoric fall.
Also, what about the dignity question? I mean, there are all kinds of figures throughout history who mount the gallows to their death without crying. Aren't you supposed to kind of man up and keep your little tears inside? I mean, I'm sincere. Like, whatever happened to that standard?
Well, where was the beast? They were all talking about how he was such a beast and how President Trump was afraid of him. And he goes into court and, just like almost every other criminal, cries when he has to face the music for what he's done.
Yeah. There is a connection between narcissism and self-pity. Have you noticed that?
Definitely.
Francie Hakes, not just a former prosecutor, but a student of human behavior. Thank you. Great to see you.
Thanks, Tucker.
Coming up next is Alex and Max Kaiser. And there's a report here on the Bitcoin. That's what Max is behind. But also, he says some very important things about the money creation that has been going on our financial finances worldwide are a house of cards. But here we go with that interview.
Bella, did you hear the 4th of July fireworks are racist?
This is what happens at the end of an empire when the people living there start to blame themselves. They start engaging in self-loathing. Because they see that they're, and you see this in Britain. Britain.
Oh, they're totally into that.
Right. They're very, what's called self-deprecating humor. Behind that is that bitterness of having lost their empire at the beginning of the previous century. And the U.S. is now entering into the same kind of phase where we're laughing nervously and watching our empire crumble and making really bad and being self-hating and self-loathing, self-flagellating. And that's what's happening in the U.S. And we're passing the baton on to China and we're exhibiting.
Somebody get me a Nerf gun. I got to tame this guy.
Jesus. It's like being in a hospice. Well, America is basically in a euthanasia clinic.
And a clown comes to visit.
Yeah, the clown comes to visit called Joe Biden. Or Rachel Maddow. And, they come around with the hospice, and it could be a clown or something, and they're trying to ease the pain, right? They got 90,000 Americans.
It's like a magician comes by. Let's do magic tricks while you're being killed.
Right. It's palliative. I was going to say, it's palliative care at this point in America. It's palliative care. It's the amount, the drugs they give you when you're dying. There's no coming back. We're in the hospice, and we're dying. And 2008 was really...
And then Pennywise drops by.
2008, but it hasn't been buried yet. Because the global financial crisis of 2008, which that we created because of Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett and all those guys, we came to a dead standstill. The formaldehyde that was pumped into the global economy only benefited China. The U.S. didn't benefit, and now they've coming to bury us. It's finished.
We are joined in studio by Max Kaiser. And he's got a lot to talk about with the world economy. We've got this big globalist meeting happening up in Idaho they don't want us to know about. Big tech cartels getting together. So to talk about the state of the world, back in studio with us, he was here last year, is Max Kaiser.
Alex Jones, great to be here. Great to be back in Austin. Love Austin. Fantastic town, city of the future. The mining, Bitcoin mining industry is now heading to Texas after leaving China. That's the exciting news. New jobs, new excitement, new opportunities right here in Texas, baby. Love it.
And I know you're here to talk about Bitcoin. I want to get into Bitcoin quite a bit, but also look at big picture. But you told me to get into Bitcoin 11 years ago. I didn't. You told me 3 years ago to get into it. And when I said I'm endorsing Bitcoin 6 months ago, I said I expect they'll drive it down again, and then it'll go back up again. So when they drive it down some, they call it a defeat of Bitcoin. But this has happened more than 10 times, hasn't it?
Yeah, since we got into it, it's been down like this similarly 15 times. Yeah, these types of pullbacks. This is a garden variety average pullback right now. What you see in the mining community, or what's called the hash rate, it's starting to pick up again because 60% of it moved from China to a lot of it to Texas, some to Kazakhstan, and now it's recalibrating. The beautiful part about this technology is that the blocks that come every 10 minutes were never interrupted. Try doing that with a gold mine. You can't pick up a gold mine or a silver mine in Mexico and move it to another country overnight. Nope. You can't.
So it's virtual.
Yep. That's right. It's virtual.
So. Well, tell folks about the 11-year history of Bitcoin and where it is right now and where you think it's going. Let's skip right to the chase here.
Right. Well, the history goes back 20, 25 years, and it was always the dream of what are called the cypherpunks to develop digital gold. Finally, after a few failed attempts, the thing happened in 2009. And that first couple of years, it wasn't that popular. I picked up on it because I had done something in the 90s, as you know, the Hollywood Stock Exchange. So I looked at it. We started covering it in 2011. And then it started to get traction. And then it started to get the attention of people who were looking for an alternative to inflation, because inflation is becoming a huge problem. And it's now the cat's out of the bag. You can't hide it anymore. And people are looking for a place to store their wealth. And they're going increasingly into Bitcoin. In the last year, we had Michael Saylor from MicroStrategy. He put billions of dollars into it. We've got Paul Tudor Jones, one of the most famous hedge fund managers in the world. He has a position in it. You've got an ETF coming, an exchange-traded fund, which will be Bitcoin. That'll be into it. There's 150 million users of Bitcoin today. So we're roughly at the same spot the internet was in 1997.
And you predicted that they would try to drive it down again, which they've done. Guys, pull up the 12-year or 11-year graph on Bitcoin, but it's already started to go back up, correct?
Yeah, it has a bottom, and it's got the user bases keep expanding exponentially, and the fundamentals are still extremely strong, and my target of 220,000 for the year 2021 is still in place.
Well, looking at an 11-year graph on screen, that does not look like something that's dead. That looks like something that is just getting stronger.
Absolutely. These are pullbacks. You know, when you go to the hardware store and you see hammers on sale for 50% off, you say, hey, great, I'm going to buy 50% off. I need a hammer. Here, Bitcoin is 50% off. Everyone should own it, and you get it at a cieper price. If you go to swanbitcoin.com/Alex, you can pick up some Bitcoin right now and get $10 for free if you use your promo code, which is another.
And that is a good, clean place to get involved. And I'm not saying it's a messiah like you are. I'm just saying the fiat currencies, the dollar, the yen, the yuan, the euro, they're complete frauds run by the globalists. So why shouldn't we have competing private currencies, especially one that has the blockchain and all this? And of course, you know, the globals try to play both sides of it. Is that because they're speculating in it? Because I really just see Bitcoin capitulation, you know, a term I invented, but I really think it's going to continue on regardless of what they do.
Well, you made an excellent point there. It's the first real example of private money. This is the first time money has ever been separated from the state. Separating state from money. It's as significant as when we had separation of state and church during the Enlightenment, during the Renaissance. This is that cosmic in scale. The second thing is, if you look at it in the following way, it starts to kick in what the importance is. If you own fiat money, you're guaranteed to lose purchasing power because they're guaranteed to print more. If you own gold, you're guaranteed to maintain purchasing power. An ounce of gold today buys a suit. An ounce of gold 500 years ago, you could buy a suit. Buy Bitcoin, you're guaranteed to, and it's mathematically a certainty, to increase purchasing power. Increase purchasing power with Bitcoin. It's a mathematical guaranteed certainty. Because there's a lot of fiat money being printed, and people...
Well, let's talk about that. We'll get back into Bitcoin, but it's a doorway to everything that's happening. What's going on with the velocity of money, the printing, the issuance of it? I see those graphs the last 5 years, twice as much money issued had ever been issued before. What's going on?
Right. Well, the amount of money being printed is astronomical. Something like 25% of all the money created in the history of the United States was created in the last 24 months. I mean, it's just incredible. And that's happening all over the world. But you make an interesting point there in terms of money velocity. Money velocity is actually heading to zero, because when the money is printed, it ends up in the hands of a few banks, and they don't lend it out. They don't actually increase economic activity in any way. And that's why you have this incredible wealth and income gap. That's why you have so many rioters on the street. There's so many protests, why the economy's dysfunctional, why infrastructure's crumbling. Because
and they want to divert off into race when it's the elites robbing us all. That's why they're funding Black Lives Matter, to make it racial instead of it being class.
They love to bring up the social justice warrior topics that are inconsequential compared to the travesty of too much money printing. They don't want people to think about that money printing and the devastation it's doing to society. So they'll bring up these tangential topics, social justice warrior topics that really are inconsequential. That's why they do it. It's a deflection campaign, for sure. And they get people really heartfelt and emotionally involved because a squirrel somewhere is starving. But the fact that they're...
I mean, I go on some of these big black hip-hop shows, and they're smart folks. They make a lot of interesting points. They're entertaining to listen to. But it's like this on a Republican or Democrat show as well. They're just caught up in their particular politics. And I'm like, hey, you know this is all a diversion from 20 million Africans starving to death under the lockdown. And they don't even know how to respond. I mean, and they're so heartfelt. I'm going, you know this is a distraction, right?
There's a book, excellent book, called Bitcoin and Black America, written by Isaiah Jackson. And on page 11, it says, he heard about Bitcoin from Max Keiser, who made the following statement. If Black America today bought Bitcoin when it was a dollar, they would eventually be able to buy white America. And that statement holds true today as it did 10 years ago.
All right, let's talk about where the global economy is going straight ahead. All right, Max Keiser is in studio with us 15 minutes into the next hour. Then I've got a special guest joining us about the globalist endgame of by law declaring our carbon-based bodies illegal and making us be uploaded to machines, which is really a way to kill us. They won't call it genocide. They'll say, oh, no, you're a trans person turning into this ethereal creature. Microsoft has all the patents. That's their extermination plan. That's coming up in T-minus 45 minutes. Max Keiser, you're a really smart former top stockbroker. I've seen you in the 1980s on Nightline and stuff. You look a lot younger than you are. You're actually probably 400 years old. But seriously, Count Dracula next to me. I'm joking.
It's all the supplements I take.
It's the supplements. But let's just get serious.
Garden in the can.
Let's get serious.
And also that scrotum wax.
That's right. No, but seriously, the economy, the world, the banks, the censorship, the wars, the China, the dollar's way up, currency wars, looking at all their fiat systems, what's going on?
Fiat. Well, we saw Ben Bernanke. You remember him? He was Fed chairman right before Janet Yellen, and he came out and complained to the Financial Times and the world media that he wants people to stop calling the dollar fiat money. And it's not just fiat money. It's not just a meme. It's real. And he's practically crying like a little baby. And it's
I saw that. So if he just calls it white supremacist, they'll stop saying it.
Yeah, of course.
So fiat is white supremacist. Don't say it.
They're boxing themselves into a corner where you can't even mention the U.S. dollar without being thrown into the gulag, which is not good for the U.S. dollar. And most countries are divesting out of the U.S. dollar. And countries.
So the Russians have almost completely divested out of their sovereign wealth fund. What's going on there?
They are out of the dollar. You know, they don't want any part of it. They don't want the censoring. They don't want to be part of the SWIFT system. They're building their own SWIFT system. They're going to be independent of the U.S. dollar hegemony. So, and other countries are following suit. China, obviously, Iran, that whole block of country, One Belt, One Road, which is the largest land-based kind of trading zone ever in the history of the world, is about to go online with Iran, China, and Russia. And they want to have it all backed by something other than the U.S. dollar. And they want to get rid of Visa, MasterCard, all the U.S.-based payment systems. And they see what's happening in Latin America, Alex, with El Salvador and Bitcoin. They made it legal tender. This is really the most significant story of 2021, in my view, is El Salvador. Bukele, the president, made Bitcoin legal tender. And now they're going to turn on their volcanoes to mine Bitcoin. They expect to make next year $750 million mining Bitcoin. This is a country with a $20 billion GDP.
And you predicted 6 months ago on the show.
No, 2 weeks ago. I said they're going to add or triple their GDP in 10 years, right? They're going to
add
near a billion right now in mining. I said it right here.
You did say
that. To you for 10 years. I've been saying to buy Bitcoin. What have you said? What have you done? Finally, you're on board. It's not too late.
10 years. Let's go back.
It's not too late.
Let's go back to 6 months ago. You said once countries start moving to Bitcoin, it'll be a chain reaction.
Yes.
So why did China, that was starting to adopt, they kind of got midway and then didn't?
Right. Well, you wouldn't think China would do it because it's a highly top-down, centralized dictatorship, and they don't like something out of their control, and Bitcoin would be completely out of their control.
What do you make of Charlie Munger coming out and saying, I want to arrest Americans like they did the head of Alibaba. I like communist China.
Well, it shows you what their true allegiances are. And Elon Musk came out and said that the news came out that he actually was in asking the Chinese government to censor criticism of Tesla. So he's asking the Chinese government to engage in censorship in anti-Tesla tweets and social media posts. So that's Elon Musk. He's totally in the pocket of China.
Talking about China, we're experiencing a pullout right now. By the end of August, in fact, they declared it August 31st, we'll be out of Afghanistan totally. But that you never supposed to do that to your enemy. But the Taliban will be in control certainly before and after that for sure. KT McFarland is being interviewed here in this next clip by Maria Bartiromo, and they're talking about what China is going to do. They're going to fill that void because there's rare minerals in there and metals and everything else. So here we go with the interview of KT McFarland by Maria Bartiromo. She's really a primo lady to both of them.
Meanwhile, the fallout from the U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. President Biden is set to speak about troops coming home today as nearly all troops have now left Afghanistan. But now China is looking to ramp up its involvement in the country as a direct line to the rich assets of the Middle East. Afghan officials have reportedly become more engaged with Chinese leaders on a potential infrastructure deal. Joining me right now is former Trump Deputy National Security Advisor and the author of Revolution. KT McFarland is here. KT, always a pleasure. Thanks very much for being here. When I saw the news that China is looking to partner with Afghanistan, I thought, okay, here we go again with the CCP and its efforts to overtake America as the number one superpower. Your thoughts on what is taking place with regard to Afghanistan, KT?
You're absolutely right. I mean, the Chinese always had designs on Afghanistan, but it was always complicated to do stuff there. Well, now America's built an infrastructure in Afghanistan, and the Chinese are just going to come right in. And what they're going to do is two things. One, they're going to go after the rare earth minerals. China needs a lot of these rare earth minerals that Afghanistan has, China doesn't have. And it needs those things, especially in its technology industry. So it's going to cut deals with the corrupt warlords in Afghanistan to get access to it. The second thing it's going to do is it's going to cut deals with the corrupt leaders in Afghanistan for their Belt Road Initiative. China wants to build a Eurasian global trading route. They have a land-based route called the Belt Road Initiative, and they're going to do a maritime route through the South China Sea. So Afghanistan is key to that land-based route. So the Chinese are moving in. The Chinese, and you said this before, Maria, and you're perfectly suited to understand it because you're a businesswoman, you're an economist deep down before you're an expert on China and other things. You realize that China, it wants to dominate the world, not with military power, not by invading places. They want to do it with technology. They want to do it with trade war and economic war. And they plan to do it in international organizations. You saw that with COVID and their takeover of the World Health Organization.
Well, that's right. And that's why earlier when I was talking with Jonathan Ward, I raised the issue that there is a Chinese-owned company called Nexperia, which is confirming it will acquire the UK's largest chip plant. We know that semiconductor chips right. are in high demand, very necessary. Taiwan Semi, probably the leadership in terms of semiconductor chips. They want to reunite Taiwan, but they want to beat us economically through technology. It's very concerning. Is Europe with us in understanding the threat of China? Because why would the UK sell this semiconductor plant?
You know, this is going to be the real problem. The United States can't stand up alone against China and all these other nations and Russia. We need partners in this. If we are going to stand up and protect our technology, protect our democracy, protect our way of life, we need partners. And the natural partners are in Europe. The Germans, however, for example, largest country in continental Europe, most powerful in continental Europe, they want to trade with China. They want to sell cars to China. So they don't really want to join us in any of this. the Brits may be a better and closer ally, even though, as you point out, the Chinese are trying to acquire a British ship company. Maybe the Prime Minister of Great Britain steps in. But I think that our better move in all of this is to look to Asia for allies, is to look to Japan,
yep,
Korea, and particularly to India. That's the move.
Yeah. And you know they get it. The Chinese Communist Party has been bullying its neighbors in the South China Sea. And during the 2020 lockdown across the world, the CCP used it as an opportunity to invade India and fight over the Himalaya Mountains and kill 20 soldiers in doing so. Look, I can talk about this all day because I recognize the threat that this is, but I want to move on to Russia. President Biden yesterday said that he, quote, will deliver a message to Russian President Vladimir Putin in regards to the latest major cyber attack against U.S. companies likely caused by a Russian-based group. This after Biden delivered a series of red lines for the Russian leader last month in Geneva. That's what he says he did, KT. But as far as I'm concerned, there's been the biggest winner of the Biden administration has been Vladimir Putin. Look at the price of oil, KT. It was in the 30s, and now we're talking about oil in the 70s. Putin has been a huge beneficiary of the Biden administration. Has it been all talk out of this administration and no action, in your view?
Yeah, I mean, it's all talk, but it's even worse. It has been action, but in the other direction. By shutting down the American energy industry, what has President Biden done? He's pushed up the price of oil. It's not only hurt the American economy, but it's a windfall for the Russian economy. The second thing he's done is by allowing a pipeline between Russia and Germany, it's another windfall for the Russian economy because Russia exports energy. So he's helping the Russian economy. But by giving the Vladimir Putin some threats and a list of these companies, don't you dare hack them, with nothing to support it and back it up, that's like, you know, it's like almost inviting Putin to take that hit. When I went to the Trump administration and walked into the White House, got all my briefings on cyber, I was stunned to find out we had very little offensive cyber capability, very little ability to deter cyber attacks.
That's very dangerous and very scary. KT, real quick before you go, I think you were spied on. We had Tucker Carlson on yesterday, and he went through the efforts by the NSA to spy on him and his team. We now know that they did, in fact, read his electronic communications. They refused to flat out deny it. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, sure. And the NSA issued a statement saying, Tucker Carlson is not a target of our investigation. Well, you know, there are a lot of other categories that you could use other than that. And really, when they put that statement out, that confirmed to me. In fact, they were looking at Tucker Carlson's communications. They were looking at my communications during the Trump administration. They were looking at everybody's. This is an intelligence community, I think, that's gotten way out of control.
It's just incredible the way an administration can use the intelligence agencies as political weapons against their political enemies. And it continues today. KT, it's great to get your insights as always. KT McFarland joining us this morning.
Thanks.
Next, an excellent report and analysis by Kayleigh McEnany, former press secretary to Trump. And she talked about what's going to happen on the lawsuit that Trump has just filed against high tech. Here we go next with that.
Welcome back. Okay, President Trump, his class action lawsuit on big tech censorship, it's now fueling a big push by Republicans to really crack down on Facebook and Twitter. Look who's back with us, former Trump White House press secretary. She's the co-host of the hit show Outnumbered on Fox News. Kayleigh McEnany is with us. Okay, this bill would let people sue social media for censoring them, and they're also pushing to break them up. An antitrust push. Here's a question for you. Why should they get protection from lawsuits over third-party content when they are censoring third-party content?
It's a great question. Yeah, they have that Section 230 protection, which essentially makes them immune from any sort of liability. It's astonishing, which is why President Trump is saying hey, you have entered First Amendment territory. First Amendment, of course, means the government cannot censor speech. Facebook, Twitter, Google, these are private entities. But what President Trump is saying is you've entered the government space when you are saying, hey, in Florida, for example, Governor DeSantis has a panel with Yale and with Stanford. You cannot have this panel because you say that children shouldn't wear masks. We're going to censor you because we're going to use CDC information to censor you. So he's arguing you've entered the government space when you're using CDC information to thus censor people with otherwise very, very medically sound opinions like that of Harvard, Stanford, Yale, and Governor DeSantis here in Florida.
You know, Justice John Paul Stevens said that basically unregulated economic power is political power. We're talking about two or three companies that really dominate the public square, and they're dominating the national conversation, Kaylee. We can't tell you how many times we've talked to people who just are, what they're talking about, their set of facts doesn't comport with the reality of the stories that are out there. So former President Trump said, yeah, social media is conspiring, quote, with the government to basically censor. He's saying effectively that the mainstream media and the government was giving them lawsuit protection in order to censor and silence and suppress the opposing views. That might be a stretch in court, but that's his contention.
It's certainly a novel legal argument, but it's an interesting one, and I'm curious to see where it goes. And one of the examples he uses is Dr. Fauci had a correspondence with Mark Zuckerberg, of course, Facebook CEO, and whether this was a correspondence that ended up with Facebook censoring certain viewpoints based on information that was garnered from Dr. Fauci, who's at NIH, a government entity. So it is a novel legal argument. We will see where it goes. But it's interesting because they're saying essentially, Justice Thomas, for instance, his concurrence opinion noted that these entities, which are big, there's two or three of them, they monopolize essentially the public conversation, whether they've entered common carrier space, meaning they're like a telephone company, which legally cannot discriminate as to who uses their product. Has Facebook, has Twitter, has Google entered that realm? I think it's a very compelling argument. Josh Hawley and others have bought onto it, and we will see if the courts buy into it.
Yeah, that's the one. It's a common carrier, right, for phone companies. In other words, if you're paying them, then they have to take, what you're saying and just put it out there. They're not allowed to censor it. You know, there's also these vague terms of service that results in them censoring and deplatforming, willy-nilly, any which way they want. It seems to me that these guys in Silicon Valley don't understand the power that they have. And how much they're distorting the national conversation. You know, Kelly, here's the thing. Pew Research did a poll last year. 75%, three quarters of Americans say, yeah, they think social media is intentionally censoring people for their political viewpoints. Are they hearing that in Silicon Valley? Now, we get it that conservatives are allowed to tweet, and the conservatives are tweeting out, their points of view. But we can't tell you how many stories we've heard of both Facebook and Twitter deplatforming people.
It's funny because when I was researching for your segment, I came across a lot of articles saying there's no definitive proof that social media, big tech, is censoring conservatives. They censor, but it's not particularly against conservatives. Well, look, let's just look at anecdotal evidence. The New York Post is censored. Their Hunter Biden story is censored from Twitter. And conveniently, after the election, you have Jack Dorsey saying, we apologize for that. Instagram, I was a victim of their censorship. I posted Elizabeth Warren's bar card, which the Washington Post had also posted. I got an apology only because I had a megaphone. But that's what makes President Trump's lawsuit so novel, is that it's a class action lawsuit. It's not just about him and his profile. It's about thousands of Americans out there who are conservative, who have been censored, but don't have the megaphone to get an apology like the New York Post, me, or perhaps other conservatives who happen to have platforms.
Now, we get it. The First Amendment protects private sector companies, right? It doesn't cover, let me back up, private sector companies. It's about government censorship. But, there's so many layers to this, Kaylee, that, this story does have legs. Kaylee McEnany, it's good to have you back on. Don't be a stranger. Come back soon. Up-